Have you ever felt like you were living just a B or B plus life? It's so dangerous to live that, more dangerous than a B minus or a C plus life, because when you're living a B or B plus life, you don't change it. You think it's good enough. Is it? I'm Susie Welch. I host a podcast called Becoming You. People think, okay, an A plus life is not available to me, but there is a way. We are all in the process of becoming ourselves. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, folks. July the 2nd, as we head into the July 4th weekend. I don't know if you watched the World Cup last night. Unbelievable. It's just so great seeing all of Americans coming together, cheering for their team in so many different cities. It was a wonderful experience. I was sitting on the edge of my seat all night long that I think my actually, I was hurting afterwards. It was a lot of fun, a lot of tension during the game, playing the last 30 minutes, one man down, and just holding on and scoring while one man down. We'll talk more about that later. Rafael Goyeneche is going to join us in the noon hour, president of Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll have a discussion about this grand jury investigation, allegedly investigating the Louisiana AG, Liz Murrell, relative to letters that she sent to public officials about certain conduct that they were engaging in, and whether or not that was public intimidation or, I guess, threats. Kind of interesting. Never heard of this before. At 11:30, Priscilla Ron joins us, Project 21 ambassador for the National Center for Public Policy Research. She is a former competitive tennis player, bodybuilder, and a high school tennis coach. And she's going to talk about the most recent U.S. Supreme Court decision about trans athletes participating in biological female sports. Andrew Arthur joins us at 10:30, resident fellow in Law and Policy, Center for Immigration Studies. The Supreme Court handed out a decision on birthright citizenship, saying that it was, in fact, constitutional. But what does the decision mean? A lot of folks have been kind of working their way through these lengthy decisions. And we'll talk to Andrew. He's an expert in this field. We've interviewed him many, many times. And we've interviewed our next guest many times as well. And it's really good to have her back, Chief Ann Kirkpatrick, the superintendent of the NOPD. Chief, 6 months down in 2026. How are you feeling?
Oh, good morning. Thank you, Sheriff. No, I'm feeling great. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, that 6 month mark, you've been around a long time like I've been around. You're always kind of leery of those first 2 to 3 weeks that kids are out of school and you're wondering, man, is this going to go crazy this year or not? And it seems like it was a very calm couple of weeks in June.
Well, we had a very good, successful June and a start of the summer. You were so right, though. You know, last year we were doing very well at about, you know, the end of May and summer months. Always there's an uptick in violence. And so we're glad to have had a good June, but we still have a lot of summer left. We still have a lot of year left.
And a lot of heat.
That's it. So, you know, heat has a role, and it does play in a sense of agitating people, and that increases risks of violence.
Yeah. Chief, again, it's encouraging when you see this month over month reduction. You know, the longer these trends play out, everyone in law enforcement feels much better about it. And it seems that y'all are still on that track.
Yes, we are. You know, the national average, everybody knows that crime has gone down, let's say, for murders nationally. They're down about 18%, but we're down 25%. And so we keep beating the national trend by almost 50% year over year. We've been doing very, very well.
Is there anything, I mean, I know that y'all have been a lot more proactive out on the streets, and I know that there's been a concerted effort, like a lot of other agencies, of collection of doorbell cameras, security cameras in residences, commercial buildings. I read a lot of, the dailies that y'all put out. I mean, y'all are making arrests in a really quick fashion, which obviously helps in a huge way, right?
Well, it does, but you are always correct, Sheriff, I love the fact of your season as points to understanding. It's not just one factor. So we use technology. We leverage that with partnerships. We build on top of that an actual intentional strategy. It's many legs to the stool, not just one leg. And so we've done a very good job of marrying it all together and making it work. So it's kind of like the orchestra analogy I use often. We got all the players playing right, but they also are very talented players. I'm just the conductor.
Yeah. While we're on the talking about technology, I interviewed Greg Rusevich the other day. The business community seems to be 100% behind assisting and facilitating and helping finance the deploying of first responder drones in the French Quarter. It seems as though we're getting really close to that happening. Can you give us an update there?
Yes, the Business Council and the business community really has been fantastic. They have supported the finances as well as understanding the mission of what drones as first responders can do for our community. So we're going to begin with the French Quarter, and we'll have drones designated just to the downtown area and the French Quarter. But we do plan to expand, and our next geographic area, as we phase in drones, will be the 7th district. The geography out there is massive. And so we think a drone approach, particularly there, will be quite helpful. So that would be our next area we would go to.
Landmass wise, just for the benefit of the listening audience, the 7th district is by far the largest, right?
By far. And it's almost like a parish, more of a rural parish. It has urban pockets, but then you have some very large areas that are not just residential. So getting to those areas can be time consuming. Getting there when there is a need and a call for help, we can get a drone over to you faster than we can get a car over to you.
Absolutely. And when you get out to the far reaches, which is out there by Lake Pontchartrain, and something happens, the drone, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think people should be very excited once that can happen, the deployment of a drone out in the 7th District, because I think it will yield just incredibly positive results.
Yes, exactly. So drones can get there truly in fractions of a time versus a police car. So that's why they leverage safety for our community.
And as far as you know, the administration and others are on board with deploying this technology?
Sure. I think that, you know, we haven't dismissed at all the voices of dissent. And I think that there are times that people, you know, privacy matters. It matters to me. I've always said that, you know, I fall in that privacy category, too. I think the concern is proving to those who have concerns or dissent, voices of dissent, is proving that we will be transparent. We will have a public-facing system where people can log in and see where a drone has flown. We're going to make that known to the community. People just want to be sure that their constitutional rights of privacy are not violated. And that's where, you know, we can do that by policy and practice. And I think once they see the value, they will be more comfortable.
And because of the nature of the video that's taking, the necessity for retention of that video in this technological sphere is not nearly as important as other technologies, right? Just because of the nature of what it captures.
That's correct. And that you were 100% correct. So it's really, you know, cameras matter to us. All of those things are for public safety. And that's why technology matters, just like the internet. The internet has way more value But is there a dark web? Yes, there is. And so but the value far exceeds the negatives that can come with technology.
Yeah, I have trouble with the overt side of the internet, much less the covert side of the internet.
You and me. You and me. I'm not sure I would know how to get there. But
there's no risk for me, I can promise you. If I get there, it's completely by accident.
You and I, sure.
That's for certain. Chief, where do we, state of the state, everyone's always concerned about your staffing numbers. I know that y'all have had some recent successes with recruitment. Talk to us about that.
Oh, we have now a new and positive story to share. We have now, for about 4 months, we again developed strategies. We understood who our market is and how to market to people, and we have, in general terms, doubled our applications, and that was the key. You got to have the number of applicants to be able to get the best out of the best. And so we are very pleased with that, and we are starting to see results from our efforts. And so good news story there.
Yeah, because the fallout in this type of business is probably greater than in most, right?
Sure. You know, there is one thing about technology is never going to completely replace the need for police officers. And so we still have to have the staffing. You still have to have a patrol car to get to where the drone tells you is a situation. The drone and technology leverages, it does not replace. And so we will always have that need for human beings being police officers.
Well, there's always job security there because boots on the ground matter and will always matter.
It does matter.
Right? Unless and until they deploy AI that can actually reason, because anything short of that, you're going to need human capital for certain.
Right.
On the line of staffing, I know that there have been a number, we talked about this last time, a number of internal investigations. The OIG just issues a report about someone, again, with payroll fraud or alleged payroll fraud. I know you guys were in the process of deploying biometrics for payroll purposes. Can you give us an update on that issue?
Yeah, so some of these investigations that you're going to see presently do stem from investigations that were opened quite a long time ago. They just kind of come to the public sphere. They can be even well over a year old in the investigations. And so what you see in the news today has probably been, not probably, has been active investigations we were aware of from several months ago to years ago. So our safeguards, our strategies and implementations of tightening down our systems definitely are in play. So, but those systems were not in play when these unfortunate investigations started to open, if that makes sense. So what you see today in the news, we were very aware of a long time ago. It's just now coming to public attention.
Is there anything, I mean, you've been around a long time, same here, and I hate to keep saying that, but, you know, you've seen a lot of things over the years. I've seen a lot of things over the years. Is there anything that sticks out amongst any of these investigations that you find is odd, or is it kind of like, you know, a head scratcher for you?
Not really. Another way of saying we're seasoned is that we're old, Sheriff. That's the other way of saying it. But, you know, human nature is human nature. And so systems matter in trying to have right policies, right practices. But because of the nature of who we are as people, you're always going to have someone who wants to challenge, who'll take advantage, who'll it's the pattern of human nature. And so there are people who are good people who make good cops, and yet they make bad decisions that at times forfeit the privilege of being a police officer. And so it doesn't mean they're not good. It means that they made some extremely poor decisions, and that's a part of our human nature.
And the disastrous side of the equation for managers like yourself and leaders like yourself is that we're really in the credibility business.
You know?
And I used to remind officers all the time, this is a business that's all about credibility. If you compromise it, you minimize your value, your worth to the agency, and more likely than not, you won't be around long.
Well, that is why some in my world, I am a person who I'm hard on the discipline side. I treat small as small. I treat big as big. And I do think that there are times that people forfeit and should forfeit being given the power and authority over other people's lives. And there is misconduct in which your legitimacy impacts the legitimacy of this department, and you have to be removed. And so I don't compromise on that. If civil service boards or courts restore people to our agency, I find that troubling, because once a police department or police chief board of police officers say you should be removed, they should be removed and should not be reinstated.
You know, it's interesting. I always wonder sometimes whether or not these independent groups that have these positions of authority recognize it's not only internally, but externally that you have no control over. So, for example, the veracity of an officer taking the stand. And, you know, his character or her character is going to be attacked. It could be that evidence would not be allowed in because of their history. I've always been curious if they ever really assess these things, because, again, you minimize the value of that human capital and the worth of that individual to the overall agency. And you get a dozen or two dozen of those, and, you're really in a staffing dilemma. Certainly, no one is prohibiting you from putting them out there, but it may come back to haunt you.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's like if you cut cancer out of the body and then it comes back, and it metastasizes. So it creates more harm to the organization when people are restored over maybe a technicality, but maybe the arbitrator will say, I agree with the underlying misconduct is worthy of termination, but because you violated a technical timeline or whatever it is, you're restored. And I'm not sure that I am full. I certainly believe in due process. I believe in appeals, and that's the balance, check and balance. But there are some behaviors that are so egregious. As I said, you should forfeit the position of being over the lives of other people. You're making decisions over the lives of others. And that's a very high responsibility.
No doubt, for sure. And I can tell that you take it very seriously. Chief, we enter the celebration of 250 years of this country, a big celebration going to be down in the French Quarter. A lot of people headed that way. A lot of crazy things going on in the world today. I'm sure y'all are meeting with federal, state, and other local officials. I guess the men and women are ready. Hopefully they're able to stay cool.
Yeah. Well, we have 460 officers out there this weekend. That's almost half of our department staffing. And so we want people to be mindful that we need them to be our partners. And I'm not being trite by that, but we have to have the eyes and ears of our community. We got to be in this together. You see something that makes you uncomfortable, please report it to our officers. We literally, at our roll calls, before the officers go out on the street, the executive teams, the chiefs, the captains, we tell these officers, if someone approaches you and they just say they feel that there's something suspicious, do not blow them off. And so, and they don't. We do not get reports from the community saying, hey, officer, so-and-so blew me off. Our officers take it seriously, and we do need your partnership. So if you keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, and report it to us. See something, say something, so we can do something. And we just need everybody to be a part of this.
And not to sound sexist, but if it's a female, definitely take it seriously, because I've always found that female intuition is rarely wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and we can't, you know, we wish people wouldn't take ice chests down to the river for the celebration and the fireworks. We know people are going to do that, but let's not be unmindful about what happened to us on New Year's Eve with ice chests. So things like that. So right. Folks, please, if you're listening, don't do that. If you could this year, just don't do those kind of things with backpacks and stuff that would draw attention to you unnecessarily. But we're ready. We've got good plans in place. And my whole thing is y'all just have a good time, but be a partner with us.
And it's perfectly okay to offer an officer a bottle of water.
You bet. Now, they're going to be out there, too. They're hot. They're going to be tired. They wear heavy vests and equipment. You work with them. They're fabulous, and they are the best of the best in this country. And so let's all work together, and we're going to have a great 250-year anniversary. I'm proud to be an American, and so I'm delighted for this weekend.
And I stand there right with you, Chief. Thank you so much for joining us. We know you're busy. Best of luck this weekend. Have a great 4th of July weekend.
Appreciate you. Bye, Sheriff.
Thank you. That's Chief Ann Kirkpatrick, Superintendent of the NOPD. We will be right back, folks. When we return, we'll visit with Andrew Arthur, Resident Fellow in Law and Policy Center for Immigration Studies. U.S. Supreme Court has delivered a landmark ruling on President Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship by executive order. What does the decision actually mean? And what did the justices decide, and where does the immigration policy go from here? We'll be right back. Stay with us.
As the U.S. men's national team takes center stage at a home World Cup, make sure you're listening to Call It What You Want, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can join me, I'm Jimmy Conrad, alongside Charlie Davies, Tony Miola, Marcelo Balboa, and Benny Feilhaber throughout this tournament for previews, instant reactions, and analysis of every U.S. match. Then all summer, we're back every Tuesday and Thursday covering all things U.S. men's national team. Download and follow Call It What You Want on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. In a landmark June 30th, 2026 Supreme Court decision entitled Trump v. Barbara, the court ruled 6-3 to uphold birthright citizenship, striking down an executive order by President Donald Trump. And here to talk to us about it is Andrew Arthur, otherwise known as Art, Resident Fellow in Law and Policy Center for Immigration Studies. Art, welcome to the show.
Mills, thanks so much for having me today.
So, Art, if we could, for the benefit of the listening audience, let's start out at a basic level. What is birthright citizenship, and what exactly are the big concerns for the Trump administration and the impetus behind the executive order?
So just to strip it down to its basic facts, when the Constitution was ratified back in 1789, it uses the term citizen seven times, but never defines who exactly is a citizen. You know, for the earliest decades of this republic, most citizenship determinations were made on the state level. And of course, we didn't have any immigration laws, so people could come in and resettle and become citizens under those state laws. It wasn't until 1857 when the Supreme Court issued Dred Scott versus Sanford, the notorious Dred Scott case, that the federal government ever really got involved in those determinations. And what Chief Justice Roger Taney wrote at the time, basically without any proof, was that under the laws of the United States, certain people, specifically enslaved people, African descendants of enslaved people, were not and could not be citizens of the United States. That was a main trigger for the Civil War, and after the war was over, Congress wanted to ensure that freedmen, as they were then known, would be recognized as citizens of the United States. So it passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which made clear that all persons born in the United States, not subject to a foreign power, citizens of the United States. That was vetoed by President Johnson. So Congress came back with a constitutional amendment, the 14th Amendment. Section 1 in the 14th Amendment is known as the Citizenship Clause, and it states, all persons born and naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the states in which they reside. So it's really that middle clause right there, Newell, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, that, you know, was a kind of a head scratcher in this otherwise clear statement in the Constitution. In 1898, the Supreme Court considered the case of a Chinese man born in San Francisco named Wong Kim Ark, and the government had attempted to keep him out of the United States when he took a brief trip abroad, saying he wasn't a citizen of the United States, he was a Chinese national. He was born to two 19th century versions of green card holders. And the Supreme Court in the Wong case determined that basically everybody who's born here is a citizen, with only narrow exceptions for children of diplomats and those born in zones of foreign occupation or on foreign public ships. And that was the definition that was in place until the 40s, when the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Roosevelt, decided that they needed to be a little bit more clear. And so basically what they said was, if you're born here, you're a citizen, with those exceptions who were recognized in ARC or Wong. So in January of 2025, the president put out an executive order. He's like, no, we need to reconsider this. I don't think that's right. And he directed federal agencies not to recognize as a citizen any child born after the effective date of that executive order. It didn't have any retroactive effect, as a citizen, unless they were born to either United States citizen parents or parent, or a lawful permanent resident, that is green card parent. That was challenged in the courts, went up, and Trump v. Barbara was the case in which the Supreme Court considered a First Circuit opinion that enjoined that Trump executive order. And what the Supreme Court did on Tuesday was it reaffirmed Wong Kim Ark, basically doubled down on the decision and the logic that they had used. That was a 5-4 opinion, four justices joined Chief Justice John Roberts in reaffirming Wong. Justice Kavanaugh would have stricken down the executive order, finding that it conflicted with a different provision in the Immigration and Nationality Act. And the three remaining justices more or less found that it would probably be effective with respect to non-immigrants, temporary visitors like tourists and students, but it really wouldn't be effective with respect to those here illegally. And so that's more or less, and I realize that was kind of long, but that's the short version of the story.
No, but it's really is a value, because a lot of folks misunderstand, you know, and so we have examples that are, you know, kind of curious to me. So let me just play one out with you. We are a port city here in New Orleans. A foreign freighter comes up the river and happens to have crew members that are females who are, in fact, pregnant. They go into labor. They call an ambulance. The ambulance takes them to a hospital. The baby's born in that hospital. Is that baby a U.S. citizen?
Yeah, that baby is a U.S. citizen, as would a similar woman who arrived at Louis Armstrong Airport and went into labor at any point during her visit to the United States, as would any student studying at Tulane who gets pregnant and has a child as a foreign national. All of those kids under Trump v. Barber are United States citizens.
So that kid then, and we know that these crew members on these foreign freighters probably are working for less money and would qualify for federal benefits, whether it be SNAP or whatever it may be, the child would then be an ultimate beneficiary to those federal benefits as a result of being born here in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, they get SNAP, they get Medicaid, they get they get all welfare benefits. And in many instances,
and that child does not have to live in this country in order to receive that, do they?
Nope. They can, that ship can pull out.
So that child gets back on that boat. That child gets back on that boat. They go back to doing business. And the taxpayers of this country are financing that child who may not ever come back to this country. And that child, there's no requirement like a lot of countries. If you can only be abroad 6 months and you have to come back to your origin country in order to maintain your citizenship, that's not a requirement in the United States, is it?
Nope, not at all. In fact, I can give you one prime example, and that's Anwar al-Awlaki. Al-Awlaki was the spiritual leader of ISIS, but he was born in New Mexico to parents who were here briefly, went back to Yemen, and basically, was the person who spouted the hateful, Islamic propaganda that really inspired the movement that terrorized the Middle East. He was a United States citizen, and you might remember this, Noel, you almost definitely do. It was a big deal when President Obama directed a drone strike killing him because he was a United States citizen, notwithstanding the fact he was also a bloodthirsty terrorist.
So that child then would be the beneficiary of dual citizenship, right?
More yeah,
likely
absolutely.
Than not, depending on the origin country. That child, as a result of the dual citizenship, receives benefits from the United States and probably, most likely, depending on the origin country, would receive benefits from the origin country as well.
Sure, absolutely.
And in the end, that particular individual would be better off than any other U.S. born to a citizen baby and family than in comparison to this case.
Yeah,
they would be
absolutely.
Better off. See, it's interesting because a lot of folks don't think this through. And, and I know what people are going to say. Well, how many of those are there? We don't know, quite frankly, But in my view, one's too many. If they're going to be able to reap the benefits of two countries' social welfare programs, right, and end up in a better position than a U.S. citizen baby, meaning a baby born to U.S. citizens, I believe that there's something fundamentally wrong with that. And maybe I'm an outlier. But, I mean, the reality is that we're participating in there are people that scheme this, right? So there are those that this happens unintentionally, but this happens intentionally.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, birth tourism is the term that we use. And, there have been many high profile cases. The Center for Immigration Studies estimates that there are about 20,000 such births. Again, not incidental, people who deliberately come to the United States to give birth here and to get benefits for the U.S. Citizen children per annum. This is a big business tool. And because it's, sketchy and fraudulent and, underhanded, we don't really know how big the problem is. But the Department of Justice announced hours after this opinion was handed down that it was going to begin cracking down on them. Now, remember when you said they get the benefits? Guess what else they get, Noel? They get the burdens. Technically, all of those children are U.S. citizens and therefore have to pay U.S. tax, whether they live here or work here or not. What would be really good is if the IRS decides to get on the case and go after all of those people incidentally born in the United States and living abroad so that the American people can get a little bit back from them, for their trouble. But The reason for birth tourism is because once that child turns 21, remember, there's no residency requirement for it. Once they turn 21, they can then petition for their parents to get green cards, move here, become citizens, bring over mom and dad and the brother and the nephews. That's, you know, how family-based migration, or what some people call chain migration, begins. This is a prime example of it.
So the whole nature of what, you know, when the decision was made centuries, you know, several hundred years ago in these cases, and then reaffirmed in more recent time, the migration of folks is completely different today. The manner in which people move around the world today is completely different. The manner in which goods and services is maybe not different. The modalities are the same, but the speed in which they do so is a lot different. And to live outside these borders and avail yourself of all the resources that you get as a result of being born in this country is relatively easy. You know, so you get to cherry pick the best and the worst of what this country has to offer, and you get to cherry pick around the best and the worst of what the origin country has to offer. And again, when I go to this balance of interests calculation, for me, we're out of whack. I mean,
No doubt about it. But here's the good news, Noel. You could be a Supreme Court justice, because Justice Kavanaugh said almost exactly the same things. You know, history changed, and it's appropriate for the court to consider the changes that have taken. Again, none of us, you know, no conservative likes a living constitution, because that's the government's hand in your pocket. But, you know, Kavanaugh says it's appropriate to take notice of the changes in the modalities of transportation and the ease with which individuals can now come to the United States, you know, unlike in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was passed, or, you know, 1898 when Wong was issued. But, you know, the rest of the justices, the majority, didn't think that was important at all. And so that's what you got.
Yeah, I got a text like this: when Medicaid is a state entitlement, how could someone not living here get a state entitlement? Well, the thing is if they're born in this state, they're presumed to be a resident of the state, right?
Sure. They can fly back to the United States, check into any hospital in New Orleans or Louisiana, and get free medical care. They're entitled to it. It's an entitlement.
Yeah, absolutely. And the moment in time somebody takes some type of action, remedial action against that individual, they're going to end up in court, and those actions are going to be ruled unconstitutional.
Absolutely.
That's the natural flow of this. Yeah.
Yep.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, it's certainly a challenge, and I try to understand both sides, but anytime, again, not to repeat myself, where we as children born to U.S. citizens are at a disadvantage to others, I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that whole situation. But that's just me. Art, as always, Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Studies. You're all over this issue. We truly appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful 4th of July weekend.
The same to you, Noel, and the same to all of your listeners. Happy 4th.
Thank you so much, sir. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So, folks, I had some texts come in that talked about it. You have to consider household income, not just...
For years, Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Through deeply reported, narrative-driven stories, we're digging into the myths, scandals, and power structures that still shape the South, and, in a lot of ways, the country itself. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
Individual income, when you talk about some of these programs, and they said, I think you are misinforming the public. No, if you heard what I said, is that traditionally and historically, foreign folks that work on these vessels make far less than what U.S. sailors make on freighters and probably live below the federally identified poverty level in their origin country. And so that was the qualifier there. And if so, they would be eligible to receive these benefits and don't have to live here and don't have to stay in this country and don't have to produce anything in this country. They can just suck these benefits right out of the country and go back about their business. That child would have the benefit of having a dual citizenship. And unless there's a restriction, and there may be in some of these countries because they are a lot more forward-leaning about preservation of their right, about preservation of a limited asset, otherwise known as social benefits, and they have, in a lot of cases, a more robust accountability system in order to receive those benefits, you may be surprised to hear, a lot more so than we do here in this country, which is also very interesting. They might not get it, but they might. And they could be in a position to do so, which would put that child in a better position than a child born of U.S. parents of similar circumstances. I don't know. I can't imagine anybody not finding that odd. And why we would not want to address that situation. If you're going to stay here, you know, if we're going to grant the citizenship, okay, that doesn't mean we have to grant all of these benefits if they're not even going to be living here in this country. And no requirement that they ever live here in this country. In other countries, big, strong requirements about going back to the origin country. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
Lemonade! Fresh squeeze lemonade! Lemonade? Oh, nuts.
Is your business struggling to be seen? Not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, mine starts here.